Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
What's up, everybody? It's Joel LaPuma. You're listening to the Complex Sneakers Podcast. As always, I am with my guy, Mr. Matt Welty.
Here we are.
And, of course, my man, flexing right now, Brendan Dunn.
I'm trying to get the energy going, Joe.
I saw you hit the Millie Rock sturdy right before we started recording. Sometimes this guy, right before we hit record, he gets his energy up because sometimes we have to pick up.
We need
for,
it.
We need to pick up the energy for the right square next to me sometimes.
we need it right now. Here's the thing, Joe. It's been such a long week. There's so much going on. We're recording a bunch of different stuff, writing a bunch of different stuff. They're telling me it's Tuesday right now. I feel like it's Thursday or Fourthday or something.
For real.
But we are very excited for our guests, so we need the energy. Welty,
absolutely.
How do you feel?
Feel great, man.
So what hoodie is that, Welty? I feel like I don't see you in hoodies that often.
I know, this is
often.
Rare.
Yeah, it looks good.
I have a Sneakers and Stuff hoodie on. Shout out Peter and Eric.
Shout to SNS.
Peter and Eric came through with the gift package. I love that.
You know, a great moment in influence is when Brendan Dunn had the SNS North Face fleece. It was a blue tie-dye.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it on FSR. Mm-hmm. And then I bought it for resale. So the influence.
Thank you for that, Joe. I appreciate the honesty. And again, I appreciate you just went straight to StockX. I said, listen, Peter and Eric could probably help you out with that. Johan could help us out with that. Somebody could make that happen. But you paid the cost to the game, and I love that.
Exactly. You don't have to put the ask in every time. Even though those new 992s, though, those new 992s that we were talking about off air, the Giannis Bendimas. I don't think
you're
gonna
I
don't think I'm going
to
put
from
the
from one
ask
Joe
in,
to another.
But if you're listening to what are they predominantly white? They're white and black. I broke the white seal on sneaker shopping.
It's official
with
big,
Fabulous.
A big step.
And I really love that it was a big step. And I really love that people listened to the podcast because people were like, "Oh, we heard him on the podcast." Welty brought it up that I was having a mini meltdown, but I think we got through it. So we're here for another week.
I'm so glad for that. I have to say, I did put the ask in, and somebody did help me out with a pair of New Balances, and they did come in the mail right before we recorded this.
What are they?
May I do a brief unboxing?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Now, this is not for me, you know. You hear the
wow, that sounded like a Harley Davidson.
Oh, I know. I know what these are. I know what this shoe is.
Go ahead.
I know what this shoe is. This is very SoHo sneaker right now.
This is I talked about this. This shoe is everywhere downtown.
It is everywhere. Ame.
New Balance 550. This is for her, though. How good does it feel when you buy a pair of shoes and it's for somebody else? You get the satisfaction of getting the shoe. You don't have to spend your own money, and you get to help somebody out. These are for her.
I like that. White and gray, white and green.
Let the suspense build a little bit.
The suspense is killing me.
And I'm not going to show the business card where they came from because we don't need to say who helped me out on this one. But he knows, or they know who they are, and they are appreciated. We're protecting every single source. Still haven't been in the store. Still haven't been in Ame Leondor, but I got the shoes, and damn it, that's what matters.
He's unboxing. We promised that he will unbox it this episode, but there they are.
I'm getting there, man.
There they are.
White and red.
Oh, so something we need to talk about that we talked about in Slack that was...
There it is.
That I would say was probably one of the few highlights of last week. I don't even know what the time is, but
lost track of time, man.
A story
brought total excitement to my life is when.
What is this story?
I know it.
Tell me.
I had said something to Mike DiStefano.
Yes, I know.
Shout out, and I was like, "What fit were you wearing when this song was playing?" And it was Lil Wayne and Drake right above it.
Great song.
And Joe said, "Gold
Bar
Sundays
Gold
with Ronnie
Sundays.
Fieg."
It's true.
You were going off.
This is a fucking story. And I cannot believe the history this man has.
This is and
humbly, quietly.
This, yeah, you guys are really surprised. Go ahead, Welty, go.
So you were talking about what fit were you wearing, and someone had mentioned probably had a Goodwood chain on, and Joe LaPuma goes, you know I designed that, right?
Yeah, that's
true.
A
wooden Jesus piece? You didn't even put that on the CV? That's not even on your LinkedIn, man? You were just sitting on this one?
You guys were very surprised by that. Me and Chris Lee, C to the JL, he was working with Goodwood, and I was
one JL meets another JL.
Remember C to the JL? Do you guys remember him?
You know what? I saw that name online a lot on the blogs back then, but I didn't know him.
You mentioned him much at Sneaker Friends.
Yes, and I missed that guy. So anyway, he was working with Goodwood, and I was like, you know, you should do like a takeoff of the Jesus piece. And it was a time where, like, obviously they were super popular, and no one could afford them. So we did the black Jesus piece, which I think Kanye wore the real one, and then it blew up. And it's crazy because I think they made a lot of money off of that design. And
we
also,
know they made a lot of money. Okay, right,
so the other thing is, like, I remember going to my mall, my mall at the hometown, South Shore Mall, and like seeing kiosks with the middle Jesus piece, mall, not shit. Goodwood, but takeoff. The other thing is that Goodwood, that really popped Goodwood off. If I
remember, and they owe it all to you.
I'm not going to say that, but if I remember correctly, one of Ronnie's Gel Light 3s was in a Goodwood packaging. Yes. I think the leatherbacks, the Jesus, the Goodwood Jesus piece. Yeah, I remember. So they used to just come to 23rd Street, and it would be like just in plastic bags, and I had the blue one, the red one, the black one. Yeah, and I got it engraved, but yeah, that was a special time.
You got a small sum, and you go, I just got whatever color I wanted.
Yeah, that's it. You know, listen, I wasn't that business savvy back in the day, okay?
I do want to shout out Mike DiStefano, because, Welty, you mentioned that he was a jumping off point for the story, and I did see him in Soho last weekend, and he was one of the many, one of the throngs, one of the thousands of people wearing the New Balance 550s. And like I said, that's become the official shoe of downtown very quick. I was hanging out in that area. I was almost tempted to go to Kith Treats. I gotta admit, I've never been to Kith Treats, you guys. How good is that stuff? Joe, I know you have something on the menu. You're super duper biased.
It's good.
I saw no line.
Listen, the JLP ice cream, Ronnie hits us up, a bunch of our friends. Yeah, and he did it so nonchalantly. He was like, if you could put an ice cream together with these ingredients, what would it do? So we were in a group text just saying the ingredients. We didn't really know what it was. Sure enough, they end up Kith Treats, and you have your own ice cream, which honestly is pretty cool. Like, there's one in Miami. People still, like, you know, say, oh, I had the JLP. Is it the best flavor? Is it the best recipe? I don't know, but
always so humble.
I always, like, look at that and always think that it's kind of like that Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yo, episode. The sandwich.
Yeah.
I don't know it.
Oh, it's great.
Who does he try to trade the sandwiches with?
I thought it was Ted Danson, right?
Yeah, Ted Danson. And he's in Larry's sandwich is like
Whitefish.
Sable and whitefish and capers. And and even his dad doesn't want to eat the sandwich. And he's trying to trade with Ted Danson. And he's trying to describe his sandwich to everyone, and nobody wants it. I didn't know if that was the case with you, Joe.
Well, it's not that bad. It's all stuff I really like. You know, Captain Crunch, Cookie Crisp, Coconut Flakes, Twix, and I think vanilla ice cream.
I need to slide through there when there's no line, or they need to help me skip the line. Because, you know, Levain is right across the street right now. That's tough competition. They need to do a collab. I need that, Ronnie. Set that up with those big-ass gooey cookies. Joe, do you think someone like Welty is, or me even, anywhere close to getting something on that menu, like a Welty ice cream flavor?
What would you get?
I don't even know if Welty eats ice cream right now. He always has ice cream takes in the Slack.
He's so fit, and you know, you have the vegan menu. Maybe what would you get? What kind of dessert? What kind of dessert would you get?
I'm sure Ronnie can do something for me.
But you may see outside of Kith right now the Kith BMW, and inside Kith, I believe you'll see the Complex Sneaker of the Yearbook.
Very important. I better see stacks of those in there.
And October 20th, you know, I know we talked about it last week, but today, as we record this, October 20th, the book is out. Go get that.
It's out. It's heading toward the top of the charts from what I hear. Welty, what do you think?
I think so. Had to record some videos for some promo that we're going to be putting out this week, so maybe you'll see our faces talking about the book a little bit, right?
I did too. How did that recording go?
It was a struggle.
It was a struggle. I had like the little mini tripod, and I had I may or may not have had the little light, the little like What's the,
you got the ring light?
The ring light, yeah.
Joe,
yeah.
I got the ring light screaming right now. That's why the skin looks so elegant.
Oh, I didn't know you used the ring light. Okay. Okay.
Come on, man. I'm an influencer.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to drop the skincare routine, but it's the ring light, okay?
We can do that,
either way.
Too.
Either way.
We can make a whole day of it. We could go to Kiss Treats. We could go to Madeline and Goats. We could hit Kiehl's for a couple samples, yep. Slide out of there with some travel-sized little potions and elixirs, things like that, things of that nature, a tincture or two.
Any big sneaker news this week? I think we're going to get into some of the big sneaker news that we didn't touch on.
Brendan Dunn got people mad on the internet.
Why?
What
did he do now? What did he do now?
Why are people mad at me?
Because you leaked the Bad Bunny X Adidas.
I don't think there's people mad on the internet. People mad in the industry.
Wait a minute. I thought that was a reported story.
I mean, it is reported, but we broke the story. You know what I mean? So people got to deal with it. This is what we do.
All right, guys. Well, listen, it's a night shoot. We are all in different places as usual, but I'm in an undisclosed location this time. But I'm excited to introduce our guest. Let's get to it.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In 2006, a sneaker would disrupt the market more than any collab, Jordan, or hyped release of that time. But it didn't come from one of the major brands dominating the space. It came from a graphic designer who had a passion for sneakers and had even more passion for making a statement. The shoe itself, dubbed the Ari Mental 10, was a takeoff of Nike's iconic Air Force One, packaged in an equally as iconic design scheme of a pack of Newport cigarettes. The bootleg design had kids lining up outside of clientele on June 17th of 2006 for their chance to score one of the 252 pairs of sneakers that were released, another rarity for an indie sneaker drop. The sneaker had a bunch of Easter eggs throughout the upper that the designer intended to activate the customers he was selling to. Messages like general warning, get off the brand wagon, and this sneaker is dedicated to the two brands who have taken the most and given the least. A clear message to Nike and Newport. Kids lined up that morning and the sneakers quickly sold out that day, but the lasting impact of the disruption of the sneaker would live on. Tonight, it seems there's no one better to discuss the current state of sneaker culture as it relates to bootlegs than our guest, Ari Sal Forman. Welcome to the Complex Sneakers Podcast, Ari.
Thank you, sir. That is an incredible intro. It's actually the most accurate one that I've had.
Wow, awesome.
Really?
Not that there's been this giant plethora of them, but I try to support small podcasts and little interviews, and it really is pretty accurate because generally the facts, it's sort of like folklore. A lot of the actual truth has not been clear. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
No doubt.
We're happy to separate the truth from the myth on here. Yes. That's exactly what we're here to do, Ari.
Exactly.
Yeah, Ari, we want to talk, like we said, about your menthol sneakers and the current state of shoes that are kind of related in that same oeuvre, if I can use a French word. But I want to go way back in your history and learn when you first really cared about sneakers growing up.
It's I'll try to keep it simple, which
no way,
I have
we
a hard,
got all the time in the world.
I have a hard time doing that. I am a talker. But to just make it short, it was the 70s, and it was with Van Doren. Before it was called Vans, it was Van Doren. And I think prior to that, I don't think I owned any Nikes. I think I had a pair of Adidas or the fake Adidas that were being made by Sears. They were called Winners. And They might have been made by Adidas. I forget. Somebody was making them. It was like Converse, I think, actually was making them for Sears. But I didn't have any consciousness there. And it wasn't until I discovered the Dogtown crew. And I'm originally from L.A., even though I've been on the East Coast almost my whole life. And these, I just noticed dudes wearing Vans. And so I equated that with you know, this look of being the right skateboarder at however old I was, 7 or something, 1978 or something. And I asked about it, and I think my father packed me up in his VW van, and we went to the valley where the Van Doren stores were. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing was, is you couldn't just get them in regular stores, and you had to go to a branded van store called Van Doren. And it wasn't like hip or anything. It was just rough. It was like a place with racks of shoes on it. And it was, you know, kind of clean. And you'd walk up to the counter. And if you didn't want anything on the wall, and this is the key thing that really got me interested in sneakers, is you could customize them. This is like 1978 or so. And I said, well, what? You know, and they showed me a sort of like a line drawing on a piece of paper. And they said, this is the model you want. I chose the slip on or something. And they had rings full of material. And it was like, you know, anything from the cliche checkerboard mm-hmm. to Hawaiian prints to just basic solid classic Vans colors. And you could, they would then take the drawing, which had two sneakers, and they would assign the materials and colors you wanted to the shoe. And then the really unique thing was, is that unlike now, fast forward to Nike ID and all this sort of customization that you can do now, they didn't have to match. And so I made mismatch.
You could do whatever you want.
Whatever you wanted. So I think the first pair I did was something like blue and gold or something. And like, you know, like Bruins colors or something, UCLA, I don't know what it was. I forget. And it was like blue, gold, blue, and then gold, blue, gold. So it was like the toe, the mid, you know, the heel, everything was different. And the power of that customization to me was incredible. And then when they showed up, they basically would call you like a week or two later. They'd call your house and you'd come down because the factory was right down the road. So they were
all made in USA.
Yeah. And you would get them, and you, it was one of one because you customize it your way. And even though there was probably people that had done it, you weren't ever going to run into them. And people noticed that and they complimented it. And I started to buy things that reflected that same kind of idea of trying to be unique. And that was it for me. Sneakers were a love affair. And I didn't come from sports. And that's mm-hmm. sort of the difference between me and most sneakerheads, is that a lot of the dudes, especially, you know, guys of your caliber, where you guys are, you know, entrenched in it, most of you guys are sports guys. I didn't grow up with sports. There's no sports in my house. So skateboarding was just lifestyle of the streets out there. And so for me, it was always about style. It was never anything other. I didn't know who that athlete was that was endorsing it. I didn't even know who Chuck right. Taylor was. Like, I had no clue. So it was a very different approach. And that's how, you know, it really happened for me, was that idea of fashion, style, and being unique in that space.
And, you know, you were a graphic designer. Would you say style, but also design as well? When it came
yeah,
to sneakers.
Absolutely. That's fair. That's absolutely fair. Because even though I was a skater, I didn't wear the skate. I guess they call it the old school now.
Yeah, Vans.
I think
Vans
it was a skate high and a skate low because that mm-hmm. it wasn't old school then. It was new school. So
right.
it wasn't called an old school.
Yeah.
Yes, it was school. And I don't remember what the name was. I think it was a skate low and a skate high, I think. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like it because it just looked like a bootleg, you know, it looked kind of like a copy, that swoosh thing, not swoosh it because we all say that, just that insignia going across yeah. to me just didn't look very interesting. And the quiltedness of it, I just didn't like the design. So I always wore, lows and slip-ons, you know, like the authentic or mm-hmm. the authentic. And what's the other one? It's the same shoe. One just has a collar.
The era.
So, I know you went to Philly, but then when you finally came to New York, like where were you going to buy sneakers back then?
Listen, I'll be honest with you. I was broke. I moved to New York with $50.
Wow.
How old were you?
I was 25. I was just turning 25, and you know, like there's no financial literacy in my family. It's just it's a calamity and comedy of errors, you know. So I moved to New York. I owed 3 months rent in Philly.
Wow.
And 2 months utilities. And I kind of tried to sublet my apartment to a dominatrix, you know, just to make a little money while I was in New York.
You said and, sublet or submit?
It didn't. Listen, I know people that know people. And it was just a friend of mine that had gotten into that business because that was her hustle. So,
got it.
And I threw her the apartment because, well, you know, and she never paid me for anything. She didn't really have to, but I was hoping. And so I didn't have any money. And I had whatever, like my boys, I had boys that were boosters, you know, most of my friends were graffiti writers. They were skateboarders, graffiti writers, and, you know, other types of criminals, let's say. And I had a lot of boys that were boosters. And one of my young boys, one of the kids I was friends with and kind of mentored, or, you know, he was a champion booster.
And what stores? What stores and what brands, though?
He was boosting. It was always Nike.
Okay.
It was always Nike. At that point, it was Air Maxes and things like that. The ACGs still.
Okay.
And it was, you know, like Moabs and 90s and ones and 95s had just hit. That was the year they hit, and they were kind of bizarre. But my boy was he took sympathy on me that I wasn't doing the crime that they were doing. And he would wear things for a few times and he would give them to me. So I would wear them into the fucking ground. Am I allowed to curse on this podcast?
Yeah, of course. And this was like Air Maxes in big jeans and then reselling them, stuff like that. Going to stores and going through inventory, yeah. stealing Air Maxes, putting them in the big jeans. You know, I worked at King's Plaza for a while.
Yeah,
so boosting.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, boosting was a big thing. But so that's what it was. You know, the big hoodies and big things like that. And then bringing them back to the block.
They would, exactly, and they would go and boost stacks of jeans because jeans, you could fit them into things. And then at one point, the hustle was Gap. The Gap had a policy which was sort of like no receipt return type of a thing. And that was it was smart. It was really good on their part, but the boosters took advantage of it. So my boys would steal stacks of things, and then they'd return them. They'd get the credit receipts, then they'd sell the credit receipts. And then they'd go and buy sneakers if they couldn't boost. The sneakers were a little hard to boost because the Koreans were really tight with that. Philly's so, you know, hood that, you know, most people, they didn't have game for that. There was some sort of like running stores that were naive and you could, but anything we had to get, and I have to say that I didn't boost here and there. I did. We would take the bus to the suburbs because, it, you know, like when they first released the Air Force Ones in 84 or whatever it was, 83, 84 or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ones that didn't have the holes in the toe box.
Yeah.
It was just like a solid, sweaty leather boot almost. They sold out in Philly so quick because people didn't buy them in numbers that we would take the bus out to the suburbs to get them. And we couldn't boost from out there, but there were some other stores that we were able to. So, you know, you find ways. But anyways, you know, coming back to your question, when I got to New York, I had nothing. So by the time Nike Talk hit and, you know, it was like my boy, you know, Air Rev and them, you know, you guys know him well. I mean,
of course.
Who's more G in this business, him and AM and those guys. They were just buying things for $20, $30, $50. I just couldn't afford anything. We had a magazine going, me and, you know, Steve Espel Powers. So I at one point I had a pair of Timberland shoes that I wore for almost a year in Brooklyn, nothing else. I didn't have anything else. And this is when these dudes were already, you know, popping. I just was broke, man. And it wasn't until I started my marketing company that was like about 2001, 2002, that I finally had money and started hitting eBay and hitting stores and digging. But I didn't really care.
What were the stores in New York? Because I know you said at one point you had so much clout in the sneaker scene in New York where you could go to Nike's customization spots like at Elizabeth Street and you could just walk in without an appointment.
Oh, yeah. Anybody that was, if you were a graffiti writer, a skater, a booster, you know, somehow involved with hip hop, it was a small community, right? And so downtown, everybody kind of knew each other. And at some point, everybody was around Supreme. And even though I was a skater, I wasn't really an active skater at that point, and I didn't come up in the scene here in New York. I knew writers and boosters and stuff because of the magazine, because I had that history of working with the magazine.
On the go.
And so, yeah, and that... because of the things that the covers and the, you know, working with, you know, Wu-Tang and, you know, Bad Boy and Rough House and, you know, Def Jam and working with all these different artists, you know, I had a good resume. My pedigree was solid in hip hop going back to early 80s. So knowing people downtown gave me a little bit of, I already had some skin in the game, heavy. And that allowed me some privileges. So as this, what would then be called sneaker culture, started to evolve, I was already there. So I never had to wait in lines or do any of that mess. I was very spoiled and fortunate. And then when Elizabeth Street started, you know, the Nike ID program in test, it was great because all the downtown kids, the local, like Dominican kids and, you know, Sammy the Jew and all these guys, they all were working there or had access there. So we were just going in there and buying stuff every week. It was great. You know, there was no, you know, Futura and Stash. These were guys I knew from the graffiti writing days, of, you know, from the 80s up into the, you know, through the 90s. So when these guys had something, it wasn't really a favor for me to ask people at Supreme to save me something, or, you know, to ask Hayes or Fuch to save me something, because we had come in the game together. So,
you know, you mentioned, you know, kind of gloss over, but you have a, you know, a close friendship with Espo, and yeah, you worked on the Air Force 2 with, yeah, him, which was, you know, the first see-through sneaker, which started a whole, yeah, trend of bootleg sneakers on its, yeah, own, which is kind of, you know, ironic in the whole turn, yeah, of things. But what was it like working on that Air Force 2? Because it's become such a legendary sneaker,
so
in sneaker culture.
So good.
It's Espo is a madman and a genius. And if it wasn't for him, a lot of things in my life wouldn't have happened. He's a competitive type of a person, and we had been friends, you know, graffiti writing friends since 85.
Because he's also from Philly.
Yeah, he's from Philly. He's really from Philly. You know, he's born and bred out there. And my family, my entire family, including all three of my siblings, are from Philly. I just happened to be the one that was born in California when they packed up the VW van. So I had a very Philly-like culture. It wasn't alien to me because my household was Philly. So when I came to Philly, I took to it very organically, even though I was a bit of an outsider. And Steve, I moved to Philly in 82. I met him in 85. So it wasn't long before me and him were friends. And immediately, Steve is the kind of guy that his creative process, the way that he, you know, his ideation works, is it's free, it's childlike, but it has a sophistication to it. He's, you know, a self-educated kind of a guy where he reads a lot and retains a lot of the information. So he challenges you constantly. And when that process came up with Nike, when he did the Jeffrey Deitch show, and that then went to, you know, with Todd Reese, yeah, James, whatever you'd like to call it. We know him as Reese, but Todd James and Barry McGee, who writes Twist. We had relationships with them because of the magazine, because it was a graffiti hip hop based magazine. And when they had that show, that opened up, that was 1999, and that opened up a whole can of worms. So by 2000, he was having this show. Nike came to him, and his terms were, let me do what I want to do. And they loosely agreed to that. And Steve was not a sneaker dude. You know, he wore sneakers like anybody wears sneakers. But he knew that me and my boy Kenny Knees, who is really the guy, he's the guy that used to always hook me up with sneakers. You know, he was a dope booster. And so me and him were just weirdo sneaker enthusiasts who used to talk about new materials and new things. We never really were retro guys necessarily. We just kept moving, mm-hmm, with the times. So Steve was like, hey man, you know, there's nobody better than you to help me out with this, because I can do the graphic design stuff for him, but I can weigh in on what would work. And the process, you know, Nike is very uptight. You know, it's not the Nike of now, which is still very conservative. But they were very uptight, and they really weren't keen to the idea. They didn't like it. And they said it wouldn't work. And it was a pack with Pharrell and Halle Berry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the artist series.
And Halle Berry was doing, yeah, it was the first artist series. And Halle Berry was doing that, like, Rift type of a thing.
Yes.
And Pharrell, at this point, was in a weird place with Nike. He was already starting to, like, he was leading the way of, you know, sort of anarchy away from Nike.
You know what's crazy? You never see Pharrell in the Pharrell dunks to that point. You never see it.
No, it's a good point. It's a good point because he saw how conservative they were. And you know, not, there's nobody that does it better than Nike, but it doesn't make them flawless, right? And they're indicative of any corporation that is so successful that they can fail upwards, that they can do all the wrong things and fail and still win and make a profit because they're just that big, that enough people can buy the disaster to make it a success, so to speak, you know? And Nike has done so many just groundbreaking things, from, you know, Tinker Hatfield and his team and beyond.
Right.
That they're really... It's hard to tell them, like, hey, guys, we have ideas. We have, we don't have two nickels to rub together, but we're telling them what they should be doing within this culture that they feel that they've created, which is not entirely true, right? It's almost accidental in some ways. Biden and Kennedy is really responsible for their image. They're responsible for the tech, and the tech, at this point, we're talking about retro things that are dated. So anyway,
it's almost secondary.
I mean, if they're truly a company about tech, they would discontinue the things that are tech liability, that are sports liabilities at this point. They wouldn't keep retroing things, right? So there's a hypocrisy there. And so we were dealing with them and saying, look, you know, we want to do your iconic shoe. We want the Air Force One. They were like, no, you can't touch it. And Steve was like, okay, then let us do the dunk. No, Pharrell's doing that, and we don't want you to touch that either. So at the time, you know, we were very partial to the Air Force Two, which in, you know, only really sneaker enthusiasts have ever appreciated that. It's never really been a trendy thing. So we chose that, and they liked that because it had other parts of the construction that gave what they felt more structure and more support to the vinyl, the clear vinyl. And they were not into it. They took the clear vinyl, they made the shoe, they sampled it, and Steve was pushing on them, and they just didn't believe it could work. And they kept lining it with liners and like almost like cheesecloth looking back things with like almost look like patches almost. And so it was clear, but we were looking at the shoe deconstructed. We were looking at the insides of the shoe from the outside, like the lining inside and the heel, like that cap that's on the Air Force 2.
Right, see-through.
And so it didn't translate as see-through. And Steve was like, no. And they kept sending samples. We still have one. I think we have the last sample, which is a different color. He has, I should say. And finally he was just like, look, they were making jellies in the 70s. You can't fucking tell me that you can't figure this out.
Not
like,
that hard. You know,
your grandmother has a couch covered with it, and that can, you know, all her grandchildren can jump up and down on it. And at last figure it out. And they did. They finally figured it out. And you know, that allowed Steve to really focus on what he wanted to focus on, is that, you know, guys have $300 shoes and 50-cent socks, you know, and $5 three-pack underwear. So these guys who really, you know, think they're about something really are about nothing. And it really challenged Nike. It challenged this idea of worth and value to shoes and people's style value. And, you know, we didn't say all that to Nike, and because, you know, they might have pushed back a bit. But eventually they delivered a shoe that was really like, wow, holy shit, this is so ridiculous and so ugly that it's beautiful and revolutionary. And Steve has told the story, and maybe you haven't heard it, but when he was wearing the samples,
yes.
You've heard this story?
Yeah,
he was walking around in them, and because they didn't fit him well and the way they creased, they started to make his foot blister, and his foot started to bleed, and the blood showed through his socks.
Wow.
And you could see it in the shoe.
The performance liability, like you said.
Oh, yes. It was a disaster. But, you know, this is where Nike will never own things as style until just recently, really, that they started to say, okay, we, you know, this is for style's sake. But
it's clear to me that by that point you were super into sneakers, right? I know I've seen some videos of your personal collection, and you had stuff like salesman samples and things like that that never came out. How did that happen?
Because when I finally got a couple of dollars in 2001, I immediately went to eBay.
Okay.
And I was looking around and I was finding old stuff, you know, like Adam and Ems and those guys were doing, I was seeing that, but I had been there and done that. And I was nostalgic, but not to just have. I really wanted to wear certain things. So when I suddenly saw European releases of 95 that were in different colorways, mm-hmm. and I, you know, no one, you know, I wasn't deep nerding out into Nike talk like that, you know. That was more, you know, other cats. I would go in and just sort of be voyeuristic and talk once in a while. But when I saw that, that interested me more. Was new things that were different to stunt, you know, to really show up and not just have an old pair of patent leather Forums or Concords or something show up and really and do something. So I, in that process, it turned out that the salesmen were on eBay, that Nike salesmen were on there. Stuff. And they weren't really talking about it. And so I knew some spots around LA and Jersey and Philly. And I started communicating with dudes. I found out it was like these dudes from different places. And I just started to make side deals where I said, look, I'll buy your entire inventory, all the whack shit too, just so I can get those 2-3 pairs that I want. And then I'll just sell the garbage. So I started selling like that stuff to like, you know, DJs and rappers or whoever I could. And parallel to Supreme was James Jebbia and oh my God, she would kill me if she knew I forgot her name under the pressure. You know, his partner at Union, which is Mary
Fusco.
Marianne Fusco, and she was just such a sweetheart to me that she was like, hey, anything to make a dollar, and I would put salesman samples in their glass displays for sale.
At Union.
Yeah, at Union. And I had, you know, other outlets. And so I was buying things off eBay. I was traveling to California and buying whole boxes of samples from guys. And it was giving me all kinds of, it was almost all GR stuff, right? And occasionally there'd be something in there that was intended to be a GR, and it was looking like it would become a specialty account thing. And they were, or they wouldn't get released. They just didn't get enough orders. And so my collection still has a lot of those samples. And what I would do is I understand the value of boxes and I like the boxes. To me, that's the real design aspect of it.
It's important.
And I would go to Foot Locker, get boxes that were being thrown out, grab them, print out my own labels that looked like the Nike labels, but they were yellow instead so I could differentiate them, put what the sneaker was and the number, and I'd throw the samples into that box and put them into the archive. So that, you know, that was kind of like, and that was, you know, so getting up to the time for the Air Force 2s, I was already years into that hustling.
So, you know, you just said you did your own labels, and it's clear that you had this mind of different things. And that was, you said, I think like 2001, 2002, let's go to 2006, let's go to the sneaker, the RE Mental 10s. To be honest, I was an intern at Complex. I believe we featured them in the magazine. I think my old editor, Bradley Carbone, asked to call them in because it was such a big thing at the time. But take us to that design, 2006, and how that came about. And, you know, we'll get into everything that happened after.
I want to be clear. And I think this is, I haven't really talked about this. I did in one situation. You guys really present, you know, sort of a professional end to this area, you know, to this enthusiasm, the collectors. And so this is a good place. I am a graphic designer, and I've done lots of fashion design, and, you know, generally nothing deep. I wasn't designing gowns and, you know, but a lot of accessory stuff. I've done in retail interior design, so there's a lot of things that I've dabbled around with. I was sort of like doing my own sort of Dapper Dan stuff back in the late 80s and early 90s. So I understand the value of an original design, and I don't think it's hard for anybody to come up with an original shoe design, one that people like and that people were willing to accept as an unknown brand and an unknown silhouette is damn near unheard of. We all know we don't wear those shoes and we're not gonna. And knowing that, it's a very tough thing to come into. So knowing that Vans copied Converse from the 50s, knowing that Nike and Adidas were just chewing up each other's designs and stealing from one another, from the Cortez on up, these guys were tearing, you know, the waffle racers. That there's been a lot of that. For me, it wasn't until I went to Japan in 2003 for the 10-year anniversary of BAFE, and I went with a bunch of cats that Pharrell flew us all out there, or Nego flew us out there. And it was Pharrell was sort of, I was coming in with his camp. It was with Cypher Sounds and Loic, who still runs his stuff, and Philip Leeds, who is a legacy in the hip hop and music industry business, who ran a lot of stuff and was sort of like Pharrell's tour manager for years, Neptune's tour manager. So there was a lot. When I went out there, I didn't really understand the scope of what Nego was doing. And when I got out there and I saw the level of sophistication, regardless of whether you agree with him copying something, he wasn't designing that shoe. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't
the Bapester, the Air Force One.
The Bapester. And I saw the power. He was creating value in something that people were familiar with. So if I were to create a flight bomber, a leather flight bomber, I didn't create that design. I'm only adding my idea or flavor or even just a stitch to it that is my own. And if you take sort of like, you know, the Stan Smith, every sneaker brand now has, you know, new sneaker brand uses the Stan Smith as sort of like their base model, right? We don't really talk about that much. So I was in this position where I knew kids, sneakerheads particularly, I knew artists and collectors and the types of people that I was dealing with in other areas were going to buy this. But initially, it had to be focused. It was an experiment and a case study about social commentary, about, you know, designing a statement and using something where it would be consumed ravenously, right? And believe me, if anybody's gone to my Instagram, they've seen the Airport 90s that I designed. That was originally the idea I wanted to do. And it just was cost prohibitive. And the production of creating that air technology was impossible because it just would be a fake bubble window. And it was just a nightmare. So I knew, I was like, well, do I create my own design here? I was like, it won't happen. I can do this later on once, you know, this has done what it needs to do. But right now I've got to use Nego's model and I need to make the statements on a familiar canvas. And since the Air Force One is iconic, and the same way that Vans took the Era and the Authentic, which was Converse was known for it, but there were other people that were using that silhouette to trace where that silhouette comes from is very hard. They made it their own, and Nego showed that Nike, who was too conservative to actually do what people were asking for and demanding,
wild that colors, he would patent do it. Leather.
Yep.
He's the man that created absolute luxury value in sneakers. No one else. Now, we can go back to the Gucci's of the 80s and how that had an impact in hip hop. And people wanted those, but they were never able to duplicate that. It was sort of a one and done. And, you know, maybe the Pradas or something like that. But really, Nego did something that had never been done. And that, to me, was very genius. And although I didn't necessarily like a lot of the things that BAPE was producing. I never really wore any of them other than the BAPEsters once or twice. I understood the importance of the moment and that I needed to capitalize and build on that in order to, I had been telling clients for years that you can take something that is essentially worthless, like any Nike ever that costs $2 or $3 to make. You know, they have to then add cost of marketing and employees and whatever their overhead is, but the actual manufacturing of a Jordan is $2-3. Mm-hmm. So literally, and the Air Force One is a $2 shoe. Believe me, I know I made one. Mine was $4.50, and BAPE, you know, the guys at BAPE thought that was astronomical because they were paying $2.50. They were paying $2.25 for the BAPEs, and mine were $4.50. They were high end version of the cheap shoe, right?
How much did you sell them for retail?
I sold wholesale for me. I took a complete loss, you know, like I was no recoup for me. They at retail, they were $225 and $250. I think they were $225 at clientele and $250 or $275 at A-Life because they came with multiple things. They there was expenses there, but I paid for everything other than one or two things that A-Life did. I paid for everything, including the parties and the promo, and it was all out of pocket for me. I just want to come back to that finish, which was I didn't design a shoe. And any conversation of people and talking about bootlegs is you have to get into a much deeper conversation of how these these sneaker companies steal from one another. But more importantly is that I never designed the shoe. I designed an idea, a concept, a social statement, and I used a familiar canvas to do it. So I made a bootleg, and people bootlegs. And I'm not doing that to cop a plea in this time. That's always been my mantra, is that I know how to be a designer. I wouldn't say I'm an incredible designer, but I'm fairly decent. And to design a shoe with the depth and the chops that I have in the game would not be difficult for me. But I knew no one would buy an unknown silhouette from a guy who didn't have chops in sneaker game on the internet.
Yeah.
And so it had to be, for me, it was about the social statement. And if I was to do anything after that, that would allow it. That would give me the luxury of being able to design perhaps my own silhouette somewhere down the line and see what happens. But that was not the intent. So, you know, to answer your question that in depth that many people have not really given me the opportunity to do is that I knew what I designed. It's a replica that they call now. It's a bootleg. And it was a social statement because I had worked with Nike for years and I had worked on anti-tobacco and pro-tobacco. And I had come from a family that abused substances, including tobacco. And so, there's a lot of story in there, a lot of story. And it makes people are bored with it when I even try to talk about it. You guys are probably chewing your fucking arms off right now to get away. But
I know it's personal. I know that your mother, went into detail about it, that the statement came from, her tobacco use. And, to be honest, I never heard that it was a canvas. You took a canvas that is widely popular to make the statement. A lot of people would think it was the opposite, that you just designed the shoe that for it to blow up. But the statement, the statement part is, to hear you say it and to hear you tell it is very powerful.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. And it's a hard thing for a designer to go and use somebody else's work, at least for me. The type of competition that that was sort of part of my growth and learning experience from Steve, from Steve Espel Powers, was that sort of like, have some respect for who did it and for yourself. Mm-hmm. And find if it's been done, don't do it. Yeah. And it's not to say that we all don't take. I mean, there's really nothing that hasn't been done. I know it's a cliche statement. And every good artist is influenced by other artists. And it's their job to sort of pick up and build on it, right? And you guys, you remember, there were tons of bootleg Air Force Ones that were, in like Louis Vuitton print. And then there was those guys, in Atlanta who had done like the Atlanta at symbol. And then there was like Greedy Genius. And there were people that were dabbling around. It wasn't big at the time. It wasn't new and it wasn't genius on my part. It was just recognizing that if I was going to create something that would be considered luxury and to have value and that the depth of the concept could carry past kids, past teens and into adults who didn't care about shoes, I needed a really solid canvas. And the Air Force One was the only silhouette for the job. It really was. The 90s, 95, nothing could have done it.
So you have this Air Force One canvas and basically you infuse it with this Newport logo upside down. It kind of looks like a flipped swoosh. You went and patented the mark yourself, their Spinnaker logo, your own version of it. You sell the shoes immediately. Nike sends you a cease and desist and then the tobacco company straight up sues you. How did that all happen and how scared were you and how much money did you end up pouring into this legal battle?
I got out pretty safely, to be honest with you. The difference was is that at this point, you got to imagine, when I released the shoe, I'm 36 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. So I'm a man, and I've had a company for 7 years. And not only am I a trained graphic designer, and I had this magazine with Steve Espel Powers, Max Glazer, Jimmy Wentz, Kenny Mees. So I understood IP issues, intellectual property issues. I understood copyright and trademarks. Right. I understood.
You went and made sure you had the logo before you put the shoes out.
Yes. And I knew what was coming. To what degree? I was naive in one sense. I understood because I had worked anti-tobacco for New York State and I had worked pro-tobacco for Newport for one of their other brands, which was called Export A, which was a Canadian brand in other countries that was trying to be introduced. And I was very conflicted about that. And because I had a company and a partner, it was sort of a voting system. And I had to just kind of, you know, accept it. I do have standards and morals, but there is a democracy to business. And this wasn't the fight for me. So I came into this understanding the master settlement agreements between the federal government right. and the tobacco industry.
Where they can't market products to kids, basically.
Right. And many other things, to be honest with you. There's a lot of types of advertising that they can't do. And I had grown up on that, and I had been affected by that. So I was prepared. I created a separate LLC away from my marketing company, away from anything else I had done, to protect my partner, to protect other people who had nothing to do with this project. This was just me doing me, and I didn't want them to suffer. But when we did the magazine, On the Go magazine, it was the nature of it was subversive. Everything about it was subversive, and we were constantly challenging things that way, even challenging the industry we were in that was trying to be so cool and easy. We were just breaking rules, and a lot of times it was awful, and sometimes it was really good. So I came at it with that same understanding and attitude. So when I did it, the only website I talked to was Kicks in the City.
Okay.
And Rich and Lopez. Shout out to Rich Lopez.
Yeah.
Rich was just, I just liked him, and that's all that mattered to me. There's a lot of pretense in sneakers and a lot of very condescending attitudes and dudes who are purists and don't want anything touched. And, you know, they'll spend their whole lives just giving their money away to a corporation that could care whether they live or die. And I was operating sort of differently. I bought Nike stuff, but I tried to hold them accountable to me. And so in this moment, you know, I was like, I gave it to Rich. He sort of had the exclusive. I had shown it to a couple people, and within a couple of weeks, it released. And since there was no social media other than MySpace at the time, you know, it didn't get onto Nike's radar or anybody's radar. I was safe in that moment. And everything went. And it was, you know,
sold out. People lined up, A-life, clientele, pairs disappeared.
It was a humbling experience. I was nervous. I knew that the quality was there, and I knew that certain people would want it. But I didn't think... the question was, this is what I thought, and that I knew that I had such a resume and there was a pedigree to what I was bringing into this moment. And I knew that sneaker people specifically didn't know it. And I felt that if the story had the right depth and the right dialogue, and that if I gave it to Rich and I gave it to A-Life, who was quintessential, best sneaker boutique of all time to me,
so important,
still to this day. And because the sophistication they put into that to make it like a gentleman's smoking lounge meets, you know, old money library, is just brilliant. And it's never been topped in my, regardless of, you know, what anybody thinks. They were at a pinnacle that's never been reached. And then there was, there were the shops in, the Bathing Ape shops in Japan, which were just stellar. Nothing like we got from them here. It was just stellar. Bape Cafe was unparalleled. And then there was Clientele. And Clientele was just, you know, a cliche little shop full of blue-collar dudes, you know,
right,
reselling stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to me, that's my duality, you know, that I really come from both of these two worlds and I understand them. And A-Life was very mad at me for giving shoes, for holding shoes for Clientele. But I understood I didn't want that kind of pretense, and A-Life presented pretense. You know, they were just the top tier, and half of the shoes were, you know, could have been consumed just from friends and family, right, and celebrities. And you know, Clientele was me supporting the blue collar guy, the little guy, in my opinion. So they sold out, and quickly, like right then. I got a cease and desist from Nike. It was sort of like six pages of outlining me trying to trademark, you know, the upside down swoosh, which is the Spinnaker logo, the Newport logo is called the Spinnaker logo, and putting my RE on it and testing the waters to see what the Library of Congress would allow me to do. You know, it got close, you know, it was close. And so they just outlined that. They never once mentioned the Air Force One silhouette. Never mentioned.
They were nervous about the swoosh.
They were nervous about the confusion in the marketplace based on the swoosh. And these were, you know, I knew this was coming. I was infringing consciously, and I understood how ferociously brands will protect it. That was the point. If, you know, it seemed to me, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all. I'm very, you know, I'm like very straightforward, you know, see it, touch it, smell it, and anything else I don't believe, you know. And I sort of felt that, like, if Nike would vigorously enforce their trademark and Newport would vigorously enforce and protect their trademark, well, I'm an easy prey. You're going to knock me out of the way fast. What about you two? Why aren't you two having this dialogue? Because if I'm Nike, the one thing I don't want is anything looking like my swoosh on some tobacco shirt. The absolute antichrist version of their of their mission statement is tobacco industry, right? Sit and die, you know, and smoke and do unhealthy things. And so to me, it was just sort of a little tongue-in-cheek, a curiosity, an eyebrow raise to, like, well, let's see. Let's see. If the World Wildlife Foundation could take away the WWF's claim to that acronym and the website, and who was bigger than them? They're bigger than the WWF, the World Wildlife Foundation, and the World Wildlife Foundation won, took it right away from them. And that was interesting to me. So, you know, to me, it was just like, yeah, what if? What if, you know, I'm going to at least propose it. And I know they're not going to talk about it. And Newport has had that logo 2 decades before Nike did. And even if Nike never knew, which I'm sure they did, I believe it was, you know, just naive ignorance, perhaps. But at some point, they had to look around and see in the 70s or in the 80s, all the promo, Newport was creating little miniature sneakers with the upside down swoosh on it. And they were doing that because they knew what was going on with Nike. So at some point, why didn't this happen? Why didn't this get served? And it was a crime of passion and opportunity. And I set it up so that I could protect myself. Nike came in, simple cease and desist. You know, I think in some ways they probably were very entertained by it, but they could never condone such a ridiculous thing. And I liked that, you know, and I love Nike to this day. Just don't have to agree with everything they do, like a parent, you know. I don't have to like everything they do. I have to agree with their business policies in every area. And with Newport, they could, you know, their parent company, Lorillard, you know, I didn't give a fuck what they were thinking. You know, fuck them all the way to hell, you know. I was just ready. And but what I didn't anticipate, and which, some of your audience probably really knows, is that that Newport was going to protect themselves against the federal government. And the first thing that they asked me, or their lawyers asked me, was, did you card kids for it? Did you card it? You're selling our image and promoting tobacco to minors. Did you card these children?
It's part of this master settlement agreement. Like I read in the lawsuit, they said, quote, they are targeted at, among others, underage individuals and youth. So that somehow your product was taking a tobacco product, which is not legally allowed to be marketed to kids, and marketing it to kids and showing them Newport and menthol and saying, this is cool.
Right. Well, as they prepared their argument against me, as they prepared their documents, there was, you know, because there wasn't social media, there was no dialogue. So they didn't realize that it was actually anti-tobacco. They thought it was like a bootleg parody romanticizing it. And to many of the people who saw it at first, and some of the people who actually bought it, they really thought it was like my homage, you know, to fucking Newport. And they didn't, because the story wasn't really, hadn't gotten around, because the internet just didn't travel the way it does now. And so there were people
that were
really...
Rich Lopez for that.
Yeah.
No, Rich. Just kidding, Rich. There, you know, we love you.
There was a few people, and even many years later, there were people that would come up to me very angry. And I was like, you really don't know the story, right? So you're... And I think this is a perfect segue probably to where you guys want to go, is that, you know, here we are now, is that people, you know, people don't do their homework. They're knee jerk and they just have quick opinions. And that's great. Everybody's entitled to have a quick opinion. But, you know, I've had 15 years to talk about this, and I had, 10, 15 years before that to think of the idea. So I know what my intent was, and anyone can trivialize it and dismiss it all they want. But I can argue it, you know, from here, you know, for the next 20 years, and I will not be wrong. And they can only disagree. But I know what my intentions were, and I know what it means to bootleg. and why. And my I'm not part of this current conversation. I'm not. But I am.
Do you remember there was right around the same time, actually, Lakai did a Newport shoe for Rob Welsh, you know, legendary skateboarder. And there was no conversation around that shoe at all. And Lakai is not a big brand, but it's a brand, you know. And do you think that was unfair for you?
No. I think everybody's got to be the sacrificial lamb, right? Somebody, I mean, not everybody, excuse me, somebody. Somebody has to be the sacrificial lamb. And if you're bold enough, if you are going to challenge life, there's going to be times in your life you're going to have to pay that price. You know, whether it's physically by, you know, you keep jumping off of buildings, at some point the chute ain't going to work right. You know, there's just something. It's just what you do to live. And if you're going to make a statement, if you want the world to pay attention to you, you got to make noise. And you can't do that by doing things that the way everybody else does. And so, you know, I wasn't upset with Newport at all. What it was is their lawyers were out of house. I don't know what you call it when it's a legal firm, but their agency of record. They're the guys that defended them.
Right.
Yeah.
They were in across the street from the World Trade Center. Which is no longer there, but what would have been, they were in World Financial One, which was like a sister building. And so they were just in there. And when they saw this and Newport saw it, they just saw it as, oh my God, they're promoting to children and they're glamorizing us. And then their legal team immediately came in and thought, global conspiracy, we're going to get paid. They were going to bill their client, Newport, Lorillard, indefinitely. Off of this.
You just said you weren't a conspiracy guy. You hopped right into the global conspiracy pretty quick.
I did. But it ended up being factual. So it was like, I didn't understand that. And then I sort of realized that Newport didn't really care anymore. And, you know, going on for 2 years, the law firm was still like hitting me up and was just like, did you find anything? Did you do? Because we made a settlement where I had to buy back any shoe that dropped below $250. Fortunately for me,
and destroy it,
and give it to them to destroy it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and you weren't allowed to talk about the shoes at all, right? And you weren't allowed to legally own the shoes.
I wasn't legally allowed to own a photo.
Wow.
JPEG on a computer.
Nothing. Wow. And it wasn't. Years later, they stopped returning my calls, and that's when I realized I was like, okay, there's enough people that have parodied the shirts. And bootlegged it, and you know the sex appeal of the most ratchet tobacco company or tobacco brand of all time was just making the rounds so fast that they at this point they couldn't even keep up with it, and the federal government wasn't chasing them. They realized that they probably went a little overboard, and so they just. I think what happened is I don't know this to be true, but my thinking is that Newport. Probably Lorillard probably stopped. They were no longer retaining this law firm's services anymore. And they were just like, we can't bill against it. Don't pick up the call.
And they're owned by a different company now. So presumably in that structure change.
A couple of years after that, RJ Reynolds bought them. And I think RJ Reynolds, with a more modern sort of take on the tobacco industry and dealing with trademark infringement and the master settlement agreement, they have a different idea about this, and I just don't think they protect. I think honestly, and this would be a conspiracy theory, I think it's like, hey, if someone's not telling them to tend to that business, they're not going to, because ultimately it benefits them, right? So and I don't think that it benefits them enough to really to care, but probably just enough to do the types of hood advertising that they're not necessarily allowed to do the same way, other than point of purchase, point of sale advertising. So, I think there's things that I know that Nike would do that they were able to put on their partners to relieve them of guilt of certain processes. So, and they were able to just claim ignorance in it. And I think that's the same thing with the Newport brand for Lorillard, not really, but for RJ Reynolds more so. They're able to claim a certain level of ignorance.
With the current, as you briefly mentioned before with the current situation with Warren Lotus with the Nike Dunk and altering the swoosh and Nike, you know, taking legal action and wanting three times the profits and for him to, you know, to cancel all the shoes and all that. What's your take on that current
situation? Well, you don't get something for nothing, and that's just the way it is. With me, I understood what was at stake, and I understood because, you know, again, I'm a businessman, you know, however great one that I am, I just understood certain processes, and more so being a designer and having that education and having had years of testing the limits of copyright and intellectual property, I understood. So I protected myself in a way, and I knew that profit could not happen because I would probably have to give it up. And I was able to prove that there was no profit. Not only did I not make a profit, that's a straight 50K loss, straight out the window. But you couldn't ask for better marketing, could you?
No.
Here we are 15 years later, right?
That's so that's very interesting. You knew that there wouldn't be a profit, and you know that's vastly different than what's currently going on.
Well, there's what's happening is more reflective of hip hop, right? And I have a very interesting background, which your audience probably knows. So, but that being said, the hip hop mentality generally is it's not a team sport, right, necessarily, and there's not fiscal education there, and I know that from my own mistakes, right? And the idea is flip, buy it flip it. So whatever it is, gotta flip that, and if you can get double your money for it, that's a good standard business practice. And if you got some, you know, if suddenly you have personal value, then you can double, triple, quadruple, you know, you can name your price, right? And that's great. But what that lacks is the sophistication of understanding building a brand and brand story. And without a real story, Supreme can be just a box logo to people, and they can be dismissive of it because they don't understand the process of brand building.
Right, the history.
Mm-hmm. But Supreme, and this is a Supreme, I know James Jebbia, I know that team, I know people that are still working with them currently on the retail and in the office. And, you know, that story is deep and it has legacy and it's true to itself. And so you cannot build a brand with that level of depth. And I mean, in terms of you can't build that value without a story. Otherwise, you can only be a flash in the pan and go away. But when you have a story and you have that depth, you can go up and down in popularity and in profit, but you will weather the storm because you have, you know, there's a pedigree, there's a provenance to the product, you know, of where it's come from and why. And
now you're using French words.
yeah, right, there you go. And it's important. Nike understands it. Ford understands it. Supreme understands that. James understands the value of being true to himself and his mission statement to his brand, and he's never deviated from it. And regardless, I've never worn Supreme, actually. Really? And it's not, I support them, and I support the brand, I support my friends. It's just, I'm not a big logo on the shirt type of a guy, and that's not really my thing.
And let's not forget, a couple years before you ever did it, Supreme did also knock off the Air Force One. They had the down one low, basically, an Air Force One with no swooshes on it. And I don't think there was ever any cease and desist from Nike on that one.
Because that's where it differs. If the sole is different and that differs, it's that 30% sort of window. But that doesn't
like the branding.
That doesn't mean that Nike's pretty good, believe it or not. If you put Nike is not vicious. They're just protecting their IP and letting you know, like, don't get out of control. And that's, I mean, they're really generous in that way. You know, I don't have to say that about them. I'm very critical of Nike, but they're very generous that way. Other brands are vicious in protecting their silhouettes. They're vicious because they have a lot more to lose because they don't have as much in terms of, you know, these sort of heritage things, you know.
Things that are already built up.
Yeah. And so I think they're more just concerned about confusion. And that's that's their legal department, and it makes sense. Confusion in the marketplace is a genuine concern. No one, there's people that still have thought that the Newport, that the Newport thing was some sort of, that the Menthol 10 and Newport were a collaboration, like we did a collaboration. And there's people that think that this was somehow a legitimate Nike thing that then got squashed and leaked out. There's all kinds of like lore and folklore and weird stuff about it. And so that's fair. It is confusing. Nike has never allowed anybody to do what in the corporate world, design world is called logo mutilation. No, they would never have allowed anybody to turn it upside down, cut it in half, double it up, split it, turn it backwards. That is a new phenomenon. That wasn't happening in my day and before. And no company does it. Now, companies realize that people still recognize their logo and like to see things happen with it. So anyways, you know, there was that moment where, you know, I knew, and I don't think that when we're, you know, fast forward to the question that you asked me, that if you just do a few things, for instance, the customizers for now have been very left alone because it's the same thing as taking a BMW and then taking to the aftermarket shop and getting new rims put on and a spoiler. It's still a BMW, but what is BMW going to do? Go after aftermarket people? That's ridiculous. These people are enhancing their core product, regardless of whether they, whether they endorse it or not. They don't, but they say, hey, this is enthusiasts need to do things. And that's what the customization thing is. Now replicas as it's just straight bootleg is a bootleg. And that's of concern to any corporation, no matter what it is. Whether you agree with it or not, it's not up to me. I don't, you know, I'm indifferent to it. I think Nike has, you know, billions and billions of dollars. None of this bootlegging hurts their bottom line anything drastically, and their shareholders are probably not suffering.
I think this guy Warren Lotus, a lot of people thought that the reason he got in legal trouble with Nike, so Nike is suing him, is because that he started making too much money off it. So he has these bootleg looking dunks, and he's altered the swoosh a little bit to look like a kind of sharper, and it's just Jason mask motif on it. And what do you recommend he do in this situation? Do you have any advice for this young designer who's about to be in a lot of legal trouble with Nike?
Just cease and desist and settle quick.
Yeah,
just get out of there. Don't fight it. Because he said on social media he wants to fight it.
He has no chance. He has no chance. Not one. No chance. There's not one chance. I want him to fight it. If he's got you know, somebody behind him that's willing to spend the money, he should fight it. It's just good for his. It's good for his brand and good for his name. But Nike will win this battle. And all, what he can do at that point is then move on to a Bapester style thing and maybe start creating his own retail or something and be able to just do parody stuff and build his own brand in the process. So, I mean, I think he knows that, and that's where this is going. In terms of the argument, there's no argument to be had. And I don't believe that it's because he made money. That's a knee-jerk response from the sneaker community. That's people who just want to believe that everything is about money. That, you know, there's people that believe that the Air Force One is the foundation of Nike's money making. The Air Force One is like a flea, like a tick on their butt. They don't make any money from the Air Force One. You know, they're making money from dad shoes that are sold at places like Modell.
Air Max 270s and things.
They literally make the bulk of their money off of, like, you know, cheap sweatsuits and things like that. They're not, this is not the Jordan brand is huge, but it's Team Jordan that makes them the money. It's not these hyper strikes and quick strikes and, you know, collaborations and stuff like that. That's marketing. And they generally lose money on those things because there's so much that goes into it. They take an L. You guys know this, but I'm talking to you.
Giant demand creation budget, $3 billion or so.
It's just they understand that all these little parts make up for a shockwave that eventually ends out in the suburbs in the working class and middle class world and gets people to just keep buying those, you know, like you said, 270s, which I actually like, you know, people hate them, but I like them because they're a little weird. I don't own any for the record. But so in this situation, you know, he can't protect it. What he can do is continue to do variations of it where he creates his own, you know, aspects to it. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to get too deep on it, but
you don't want to give him any free ideas.
I mean, I think he knows. but I'm not trying to give everybody out there. It's not an idea. It's just, I don't want to send people down a path. They're like, oh, that's what I should do. Look, if you don't have good ideas and you don't have a good reputation, like, you can make some money, but you know, it's not as simple as people think it is. And if I didn't have the resume and the pedigree, we wouldn't be having this conversation. My brand story was there. And I think this gentleman is creating his brand story, but with this moment,
right.
But it's going to be one and done. And, you know, here's the statement to the overall, everybody getting out there, push it, do it. If it's a bootleg,
just do it.
Just do it.
Sounds familiar, Ari.
It's never going to hurt them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's never going to hurt them. And they probably need the entertainment. But more importantly, I'm not doing it because I think that, you know, people should attack Nike. I love Nike and I still buy Nike products. I think people should do it because out of this, maybe some new brands will be born. And that's important. It's important because for the longest time, we only had ABC, NBC, and CBS. Mm. And then Fox came in, regrettably, and has has really changed the game. They created a network that opened up more blue-collar sort of programming, black programming and white blue-collar programming, and challenged sort of the status quo of the three big boys. And now the internet has come and we have streaming. So now people can get their entertainment from, you know, from Prime and Netflix and all these different places. Now we have many players in the content creation game for advertising dollars. And I think that the sneaker world is still archaic in that way, that it's still about one big player. And then there's a couple secondary players of Adidas and maybe Reebok and, you know, Puma kind of, tertiary in the argument. And we need more. And the only way that's going to happen is it's going to happen when someone does something disruptive, challenges the status quo, has some kind of resume to do so, and then the missing element, athlete endorsement.
Got it.
So if someone can come up with a good silhouette and a good partnership, you can now go to the guy right now who's about to enter the NBA and make him a partner, and it's off and running. So long as you've got a good product. It can't be, you know, the ball sneaker or any
big
of those.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Or what was his name from Marbury when he did the 1999 cent, you know, sneaker. Good idea. Just ahead of its time, I think, unfortunately.
Ari, when you saw Jeff Staple get involved, did that surprise you? That he had done the Nike projects and then, you know, co-signed the essentially bootleg?
Did it surprise me? I don't really know what to think about that. I respect Jeff. And Jeff has skin in the game like few people do, you know, in every direction
right.
of design and streetwear and, you know, these long before these things even had cultures and titles. And so Jeff has been probably pretty conservative compared to some other people, compared to Inigo, but also very controversial compared to, you know, his own partners of like Nike and stuff. Right. So Jeff is a good example of, you know, moving through a space over time. Yeah, I think so. And so at this point, obviously, he wasn't creating new things with Nike. And I think he probably, you know, I don't know what Jeff is thinking, but I would think that he was encouraging young creatives, you know, and I think that he understands that. And I can't speak for Jeff, but I wouldn't encourage young creatives. I'm not encouraging somebody to go and knock off, you know, the menthol 10s and it's been done many times, but I try to discourage it and talk about it and say, listen, don't cheapen the message by just wanting to give people their version of a Newport cigarette to wear. That's not what this was about. And I'm not Nike. So I only have, and when it comes to sneakers, this is what I have. You know, this is my legacy. Don't dirty my legacy. Totally. You know, it's just not, and it's not hypocritical. I'm a bootlegger, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially, you know, if we're going to call it what it is, I bootlegged something in order to do something else. And so I don't want people to think that I'm hypocritical. I'm just saying, please, this message, this anti-tobacco message, this corporate responsibility message, this understanding that people need to challenge IP, intellectual property and copyright is important. And by you guys going out there and just doing that because it's cool and it's crazy, mm-hmm. and you want to have your version of the legacy, is not okay. If you know, I don't mind customization, and the bootlegs are out there. They exist. There's people getting robbed in China as we speak. I've seen it. So it's out there. But it's, you know, I'm just trying to keep the integrity of the message as long as I can. And, you know, there's a lot of really bad bootlegs out there of it. And then there's some good things that have happened. And you know, I applaud those guys who had the discipline to just make a few shoes and leave it at that. But, you know, I can't, again, I don't want to be hypocritical. I'm just trying to protect not my interests, because I never made any money. I lost money on it. I'm trying to protect the legacy of the Menthol 10 as a story, because I'm not, the Menthol 10 is much bigger than me. That's for damn sure.
And to that point, I think a good way to cap it off, we shoot with Lil Yachty a lot, and I remember that the Menthol 10s was one of his grails, and he's like a really serious collector. So to see someone of a younger generation and the shoe still to hold up is, you know, it's a testament to the staying power of the shoe. And, you know, as far as this podcast, I think you were so great to get your insight on this, and really, definitely someone who has a lot of history in those New York City days. And I remember, when I was an intern, I remember you as a figure running around downtown. So it
really?
Was, I started at Complex like 2005, 2006. So it was right around the time that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you were like,
I was probably up in Complex at that time, running around.
Definitely.
You know, talking to people. You know, my man James Ling.
Oh, James. Go of ahead, course. Yes, James Ling. So. Ari, it was great to talk to you and reconnect with you. And thank you for giving us your time.
And let me give you your flowers. Thank you, gents, for giving me the platform and entertaining this nonsense. And
definitely not nonsense.
Quite honestly, and for doing what you do. You know, I know it sounds kind of cliche, but I appreciate what you guys do. And thank you for, you know, thinking that I'm somebody that should be part of the conversation. It's very gracious of you. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And not nonsense at all. I think we're so happy to have this conversation and to have differing viewpoints or people who are ready to challenge brands or challenge these traditional ideas of IP or how we should feel about being marketed to. And also, we have to thank the person who made this all possible, a friend to all of us, Sarah Honda.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Honda.
In your infinite grace, we may have to just go for another hour talking about how great Sarah Honda is, a Complex employee, a person who's done everything in the industry.
I love you. You've been an asset to everything I've ever done in hip hop.
We all love you.
Yes.
Yeah. And thanks for bringing me together with these gents and this conversation. You're a rare one, and your story in history will be written.
Ari, thank you so much, man.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Have a good night.
Our producer is Dave Matthews. Our associate producer is Jasmine Plata. Sound engineering done by William Smith. Special thanks to Jennifer Stewart and Shiva Bayet. The Complex Sneakers Podcast is a production of the Complex Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.